The non-rulers of the Israelites were made slaves to be led out on an exodus by land by Moses, some 40 to 100 years, Moses being born after the throw out of the shepherd kings, and then some 80 years after his birth, Moses leads him out. This Cyrus Gordon wrote before Columbus. None of that's in this book, by the way. Before Columbus, links between the Old World and ancient America. All that was just triggered by Cyrus Gordon being referenced. Professor Gordon hypothesizes a Bronze Age seafaring culture that in the pre-Columbian era diffused Old World cultures across the Atlantic to the New World. Gordon's work reinforces Donnelly's diffusion theory by suggesting that prehistoric man was. You want me to continue, you get on the telephone. You're starting to get the pattern? It should be noted that diffusionism is alive and well in a recent book by linguist and historian Cyrus H. Gordon, Before Columbus, Links Between the Old World and Ancient America, the name of the book. Professor Gordon hypothesizes a Bronze Age seafaring culture that in the pre-Columbian era diffused Old World cultures across the Atlantic to the New World. Gordon's work reinforces Donnelly's diffusion theory by suggesting that prehistoric man was more far-ranging in his travels than previously realized. 20th century anthropologist and explorer Thor Heyerdahl was sufficiently impressed with the notion of Egyptian crossings of the Atlantic to undertake such a voyage himself in his reed boat, Ra. The impact on Atlantean studies of Donnelly's pioneering investigation was obvious to me in the writings of Lewis Spence, who lived from 1874 to 1955. Until his death, Spence was the foremost student of Atlantis in this country. A Scottish mythologist, Spence wrote nearly 50 books, four of which are directly related to Atlantis. One, The Problem of Atlantis. Two, Atlantis in America. Three, The History of Atlantis. And four, The Occult Sciences in Atlantis. The first of these books, reprinted in 1972 as Atlantis Discovered, is regarded by the Atlantis skeptic L. Sprague de Camp, writing in about 1970, is, quote, still the best pro-Atlantis book published to date. One reason for his opinion may be the fact that Spence claims no more than a Stone Age culture for Atlantis, about on a par with the Mayan and Incan cultures. These later cultures, of course, had rich inner lives. The Mayas, at least, had an evolved astronomy and mathematics. The limits of the term Stone Age have been recently recognized and is therefore less frequently used in professional circles, but the skeptic de Camp could live with Spence's belief about Atlantis because it didn't project a superior, bordering on supernatural, race. Spence, with the advantage of a more recent anthropology and paleontology, located Atlantis in the Atlantic Ocean and maintained that it sank by degrees. First, it was a continental mass that began to break up late in the Miocene geological period, beginning about 25 million years ago, finally separating into two smaller masses, Atlantis and Antillia. This later located by Spence in the vicinity of the present West Indies. And these island continents continued to exist until about 25,000 years ago, when Atlantis further disintegrated and was at last totally destroyed about 10,000 B.C. In Spence's theory, some parts of Antillia still survive in the West Indies, although he does not draw specific attention to the Bahamas. Turn me up a little. This piecemeal destruction in phases, while it runs counter to Plato's overnight version in one terrible day and night, is more compatible with geophysical evidence and also with the accounts of the seer Edgar Cayce. Spence equated two of these destructions with three cultural waves that seem to have reached Europe from the West. And this is one of, as I told you the other night as I read from the History of Atlantis, each book among the some 5,020 languages has their own, or its own, unique contribution. In addition to the agonizing tale of on-site inspections, this book is good because it is one of the most complete synopsis of all the writings on Atlantis contained anywhere in a few short pages. Spence equated two of these destructions with three cultural waves that seem to have reached Europe from the West. These were the Cro-Magnon or Ignatian culture, dated in Spence's day at about 25,000 years ago. That's the first of the three. Second, the Magdalenian or Cro-Magnon culture of about 16,000 years ago. And three, the Azelian, Tardanosian, of about 10,000 years ago. The respective current dates for these cultures are 34,000 to 27,000 B.C. You say, how could that be? The Earth's only 4,000 years old. Or 6,000. 4,004 B.C. is when it's created. Well, the old bishop who built his theories on genealogies didn't live between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. And why did God tell Adam and Eve to replenish the earth? Why didn't he just tell them to plenish it? I think God knew how to say what he meant. If he didn't. The respective current dates for these cultures are 34,000 to 27,000 B.C., 15,000 to 10,000 B.C., and 8,000 to 6,000 B.C. In Spence's opinion, these cultures left Atlantis one after another because of natural catastrophes. And his theory is they made their way to Europe. In particular, the Cro-Magnon man of the Aurignacian and the Magdalenian cultures seems to have been highly developed before reaching the Iberian Peninsula, since evidence of earlier Iberian development is lacking. An Eastern origin seems to be precluded because Neanderthal man was located there. Cro-Magnon man appears not to have been a descendant, but instead was apparently a conqueror of Neanderthal man. The Aurignacian and Magdalenian cultures produced the stunning cave paintings found in France and Spain. Their extraordinary sense of anatomy and perspective in drawing, the ancient artist used even the curve of the cave wall to enhance their art, suggest a surprising modern quality for Stone Age cultures. These cave paintings also reveal a central concern of Cro-Magnon man, the bull. Bulls, it will be recalled, were a sacred animal in Plato's version of Atlantis. They're also found elsewhere. In the Mediterranean, there was the sacred bull of Egypt, Apis, and the bull of the Minoans on Crete. Egerton Sykes, a fellow of the Royal Geographic Society, and Ignatius Donnelly's editor, succeeded Spence as a foremost researcher of Atlantis. Sykes brings great depth of learning in the classics to the Atlantean problem. He is now the editor of Atlantis, an interesting publication now in his 28th year, whose recent issues have focused on the Bermuda Triangle and Bimini. The journal is an excellent source of knowledge about the work of Atlantologists around the world. Also among the pro-Atlantis books is Charles Berlitz's The Mystery of Atlantis. I found it a helpful survey of the various theories that remove Atlantis from the Atlantic and locate it in North Africa, Scandinavia, and elsewhere. Charles Berlitz, grandson of M.D. Berlitz, who established the worldwide Berlitz language schools, is himself in command of 30 languages and is a scuba diver. He is a good example of today's researcher who realizes that library investigation must be complemented by personal field study of various sites. The strength of Berlitz's book is, as might be expected, in the area of linguistics, and as I have been saying, each of the books make their own particular contribution. Two examples from Berlitz's work, by the way, to show you the bulls. There's no bull, man. The Sumerian bull man. Peter. How do I get this picture here? Bull shrine from Kartalhöyük, Turkey, dated 6000 BC. Egyptian god Mentu, the bull man. Mesopotamian bull king, Naram Sin. Indus Valley, bull seal. Sacred bull Apis in Egypt. Universally, the bull worship dates these ancient cultures. Now, an Aztec manuscript, come here, Peter, locates Aztlán. Interesting. In its coincidence of shape and form and in the symbols when they're understood more to the story of Plato, the Aztecs having in their cultural memory traces a concept of ancient Atlantis. But back to Berlitz. Two examples from Berlitz's work illustrate the role of language in the Atlantean problem. First, the Aztecs referred to their original homeland as Aztlán. An echo of the original sunken land? Particularly in Aztec, Atl means water. Across the Atlantic in the Berber tribe of North Africa, the same word has the same meaning. These and other parallels suggest to Berlitz, on each side of the Atlantic, common words, cognates, suggest the common origins in Atlantis. In the following example from Berlitz's book, The Idea of Chance Origins in Widely Separated Linguistic Islands of Sounds, with amazing similarity, seem quite improbable, such as the word father. Over here, Peter. Basque, talking about the word father now. Don't expect me to pronounce them all right, but I'll give it a try. Basque suspected Atlantean fossil language. Aita. Ketua. Taita. Nahual, Aztec dialect. Tata, or Tadli. Zuni, Takchu, or Taku. Welsh, Tad. Fijian, Tata. Turkish, Atta. Maltese, Tata. Romanian, Tata. Samoan, Tata. Dakota, Sioux Indian, Ate. Seminole, Entiti. Tagalog, Philippine Island. Tete. Sinhalese, Tata. You can say, well, that's just baby talk. Well, you know, couldn't the Tagalog people on one side of the world in the Pacific Ocean and the Philippines have mixed them up from the Basque, and when they run into each other, the baby would be calling the father Dada or Tata in the Basque language, and the Tagalogs could be calling the father Mama. I mean, who codified this baby talk to where the male gender parent would nod and smile to Tata or Tad instead of Mama or Mad? Comprenez-vous? Berlitz lays a pretty powerful case down with more equipment to study languages than most who get on the subject. For Berlitz, these parallels imply an earlier diffusion of language than is currently recognized. Okay, Peter. Of course, the anti-diffusionists argue that such developments in language are a matter of chance, like I just suggested. Chance. No baby ever called the male parent Mama. It's just something about a baby's palate that produces Tad or Dad or Dada or Tata. In the area of linguistics, as in other disciplines brought to bear upon a problem as difficult to pin down as Atlantis, we're not talking about proof. We can only talk about the more or less probable. In researching contemporary Atlantean theory, one of my surprises was the discovery of a strong interest among a number of Soviet academicians. Not only is the subject taken seriously there, Atlantean research is being pursued with an impressively broad outlook. Doctor of Chemical Sciences N.F. Zirov, writing almost 20 years ago in Edgerton Sykes' journal Atlantis, said that the study required, quote, scholars with adequate encyclopedic perspective, since proof of its reality consists of a complexity of innumerable small facts and observations connected with diverse branches of science. In other words, the Gestalt view. I was especially intrigued by a 1961 book published by the Russian state publisher of children's literature entitled, quote, In Search of the Lost World, Atlantis. Its 20 chapters were as scientifically sophisticated and comprehensive in its treatment of the topic as many adult books in the West. The background I received from the above theorists gave me an invaluable opportunity to confirm or reject elements of my own slowly developing hypotheses. However, my attitude was also shaped by evidence from other areas. One source of information that had a tremendous impact on my theory and brought an entirely new approach to the problem was the American psychic Edgar Cayce. As I read more and more of his material, I found myself highly impressed with the internal consistency of his readings on Atlantis. Now, readings has become a word of art in regard to Edgar Cayce. He would go into a trance-like state, appearing to be asleep, and give what they call readings, in which he would recite these things, and it was transcribed, taken down, and then transcribed. And some of his most lengthy readings were on Atlantis. As I read more and more of his, Edgar Cayce's, material, I found myself highly impressed with the internal consistency of his readings on Atlantis. Within the mass of information he gave are medical and psychological readings that have demonstrable practical utility for gains in health and personality growth, factors which make Cayce's account of Atlantis difficult to ignore. Even his originally improbable claim of over 10 million years for man's presence on the planet begins to seem more plausible as science pushes back the past. The Leakeys have put man's origin at least 3.75 million years ago. But Adam was created in 4004 B.C., you say. The Cayce readings trace Atlantis from its beginnings through its golden age and then on through three increasingly drastic earth changes, including the one that finally destroyed the civilization. These three increasingly drastic earth changes occurred at about 48,000 B.C., 28,000 B.C., and 10,700 B.C. Now we're getting further and further back. Cayce's Atlantis featured great stone cities, modern communications, including electronics, land, air, undersea transportation, the neutralization of gravity. Not much trouble moving the stones around. The neutralization of gravity and the harnessing of solar energy by means of the great crystals or firestones. This exotic technology is probably the most bizarre aspect of Cayce's account. What was accomplished with this high technology, however, begins to look like a script for the decline of our own present civilization. From its golden age, Atlantis deteriorated spiritually and morally until the great forces of nature, available through the crystals, began to be misused. This technological abuse eventually caused at least one of the cataclysmic events, that which caused the final destruction through violent earth changes. The deterioration of Atlantis was a total decline of a great civilization. In its last phases, at least in moral and psychological terms, it suggests the latter days of the Roman Empire. Atlantis' original spiritual awareness and her citizens' selfless discipline gave way to increasing materialism, sexual perversion, exploitation, and slavery. The decline was marked by a sharpening conflict between the sons of the law of one and the sons of Belial. The sons of Belial ultimately came to practice human sacrifice, sexual license, including psychic control of others for sexual purposes, and finally the misuse of the forces of nature. The firestones, which earlier had been used for healing, began to be employed in punishment and torture. As I read these details, I wondered if such abuse and the psychic exploitation of others might represent the beginnings of black magic. Setting aside the paranormal elements and the sophisticated technology, the moral decline parallels Plato's story and other accounts of more recent vintage from psychic sources. The Atlanteans, many of whom Cayce saw incarnated in the present century, were extremists, either desiring greatly to serve mankind or to exploit others. Cayce saw that many had individual or group karma involving exploitation of others, a debt which has yet to be worked out through love and service. Intrigued by Cayce's readings, but feeling I now needed grounding in a more concrete area, I turn to geological evidence for the existence of Atlantis and learn to my surprise that this science, geology, this science's foundations were far less solid than I had expected. Geology is now dramatically readjusting long-held conceptions of Earth history. The geology of Atlantis, as described by Plato, you know, this is getting almost like a classroom. You want me to continue this summary of Atlantean theories, and then we'll proceed with his on-site inspections?